Thanks for inviting me. Today we'll speak about mostly one paper, the second one, but there will be something from this previous paper from January. The second is a paper with Fernando, Condor, and Shinan, while the first was done only with Condor and Shinan. And the topic is the study of gluon scattering in ES with CFT techniques. So first of all, let me give you an overview of the subject and motivation for why these kind of things are interesting. The context that I will consider is that of ADS-CFT, which, as I'm sure you all know, relates a conformal field theory in d dimensions defined on it relates a conformal field theory in d dimensions to string or M theory on a d plus one dimensional anti de Sitter space. And in particular, operators in the CFT on the boundary of ADS are related to excitations of ADS fields on the boundary of ADS. And the objects that I will consider all the time in this talk are correlators of four operator insertions in the CFT. And these observables are then dual to sort of scattering amplitudes or the natural analog of scattering amplitudes in anti de Sitter space. I will consider the setup in which we have a small parameter, which I'm calling G here. And so we can perform an expansion in this small parameter. For instance, in the case of n equals 4 super young males, this will be the rank of the gauge group or the number of D3 brains, according to the perspective that you want to take. And this is taken to be small, and it is small in the case where we have a weakly coupled supergravity description in the bulk. So the CFT may be strongly coupled, but we always have a weakly coupled Lagrangian in ADS, even though we don't need to know the details of it. So we have this expansion, and here I drew schematically some of the terms in the expansion. The first represents disconnected contributions. It is completely trivial, so I will not speak about it. Whereas the second is a three-level diagram, and it will be the focus of this talk. After that, we have loop contributions. And in particular, for the kind of computations that I will describe, one loop is actually the state of the art. Only a few cases are known. So already three level is quite non-trivial, and people didn't know everything about this until very recently, even in the simplest cases. And loops are interesting stuff for the future, or very little is known in some cases. So since the state of the art is one loop, it's easy to see how this is a relatively hard problem. And to simplify the problem, it's useful to introduce supersymmetry, and in particular to focus on the half PPS sector of theories with some superconformal symmetry. The simplest case then will be that of with maximal superconformal symmetry, so 16 Poincaré supercharges. There are essentially only three cases if we take large N, so we kind of neglect some details, which are, of course, ADS4 crosses 7, ADS5 crosses 5, and ADS7 crosses 4 from the point of view of supergravity. In these cases, the half BPS operators are operators in the symmetric spaces representation of some SON group. So they have this SON is just the R symmetry of these three theories. And these half PPS operators carry K symmetrized indices. The case of K equals 2 corresponds in all cases to the stress tensor multiplet. And we know that the stress tensor in the CFT is dual to gravitons in ADS. So what we are describing is the interaction of gravitons from a gravity perspective. Whereas for K greater than 2, these CFT half PPS operators are the Kaluza-Klein modes of the graviton on the sphere, on the 7, 5, or 4 sphere. And collectively, I will denote these operators as supergravitons. And people started computing this stuff very early on when ADS-CFT was discovered. But only after 20 years of efforts, all the correlators for arbitrary weights, for arbitrary values of these Ks, for the supergravitons, were computed at three level in this paper by Fernando and Shinan from June last year, using a new idea, which is that of the MRV limit, which I will describe later in the talk. So this was done 1 year ago. And then the next to simplest case that one would like to consider is that of half maximal supersymmetry. So 8 Poincaré supercharges. And in this talk, I will describe how one can apply this idea of the MRV limit, which in simple terms is just a choice of a special configuration in the space of R-symmetry polarizations, to simplify and compute correlators between half BPS operators in large classes of SCFTs with 8 Poincaré supercharges in dimensions 3, 4, 5, and 6. And the result, so what I will present in this talk in the end, is all the correlators between these half BPS operators. And in the case with half maximal supersymmetry, these operators do not correspond to gravitons in EDS, but rather to gluons. And this is why I'm claiming that we're going to discuss gluon scattering amplitudes in EDS. Let me also motivate why these kind of observables are interesting. First of all, they allow us to learn about conformal field theory from gravity. One more in general would like to learn about strongly coupled QFTs, which is of course very hard. And focusing on CFTs makes life simpler, but still analytic computations are very hard. So we are quite lucky to have ADS-CFT because we can take then large N, and we have a dual description of our large N CFT, which is a weakly coupled supergravity in the bulk. And this allows us to access sectors of strongly coupled or non-Lagrangian CFTs, non-protected data in the CFT that would be otherwise very hard to compute without a Lagrangian. So this is we can learn about CFT from gravity. And I will be focused on analytic computations. So bootstrap techniques, but analytic kind of computations. On the other hand, we can also learn about gravity from conformal field theory. And in particular, ADS-CFT can be used as a definition of gravity in ADS, of quantum gravity in ADS. And if we take, for instance, one simple example of the observables that we'll be interested in, which is the scattering amplitude between 4 closed strings. So this is like string theory, and we know a bit about it perturbatively, at least in flat space. This amplitude is a function of alpha prime, the string tension, the string coupling constant, and then some Mandelson variables. And we can expand it in this G string. And at every order, we have genus 0, genus 1, and so on. Every order is also a function of alpha prime, and we can also expand in alpha prime. And so we see, just from this simple example of the 4 tachyon amplitude, many features that I will discuss later. So the genus 0 or string 3 level contribution contains a supergravity term that comes just from some classical supergravity, and it is essentially all I will compute in this talk. But then one has alpha prime corrections, which from the supergravity point of view are higher derivative corrections. And then, so supergravity, higher derivative, and then also loops. So in this talk, I will consider this term, which is the first and the simplest, because nothing about even the supergravity term was known for gluon scattering. But then, of course, the goal for the future is to include higher derivative corrections and loop, and actually study how quantum gravity behaves, the way that quantum gravity behaves in ADS. So in particular, the idea is to use CFT techniques to study these effects of quantum gravity, and also to study the effective actions of string and especially M theory perturbatively. So by studying the consistency conditions on these 4-point functions, the hope is that one can fix the coefficients that appear here in this expansion that I haven't written down. And this corresponds to coefficients in the effective actions, and especially for M theory, some of these coefficients are not known. And finally, more and more results are becoming available about these holographic correlators, which are really scattering amplitudes in ADS. And we know that for scattering amplitudes in flat space, since many years ago, there has been a rich story and an interesting program that revealed hidden structures that one cannot see from the Lagrangian, but are apparent in the amplitudes. And they're interesting both from the physics perspective and from the math perspective. And so we can learn lessons about QFTs from the amplitudes independently of the Lagrangian description. And a natural question is is what happens in curved space? So if one can generalize these structures in curved space, and the simplest case to look at, because it has constant curvature, is anti-de Sitter space. And also because we can use the CFT. So questions that one can ask in this context are, first of all, if there are generalizations of the flat space structures to anti de Sitter space, and here I've just listed a few. And moreover, if there are new hidden features for anti de Sitter amplitudes that we don't know of in flat space. And that's it for my introduction to the topic. So please ask questions now or in general during the talk if you have some.
Can you go back a couple of slides?
Yeah. To which one?
The one where you had the G. Yeah. So here you're talking about quantum gravity, but
yes.
When presumably you're doing this when G string is small, right?
Yes.
So when G string is small, what's bigger, the string scale or the Planck scale length?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
So there are two scales in string theory. The string.
Yes. Oh yes, I'm taking both G strings and alpha prime to be small.
Yeah, so I'm asking in this regime, is the Planck length smaller or larger than the string length?
They're both small, and so there is a limit in which they're both small, and you have this leading term. And then you can tune them separately.
I guess I'm asking: Are you able to compute L Planck correction?
No, that's the point. Not yet. So in the cases that I'm considering, I'm really just focused on these. So I'm taking them to be zero essentially.
Yeah. So I'm saying maybe the name quantum gravity might be a bit misleading.
No. So the point that I was trying to make is, we're not doing quantum gravity yet. There were no known results in ADS for the theories that I'm considering, even for this semi-classical supergravity. So what I'm doing today is tell you the story about semi-classical supergravity, and one then uses that as a basis to build the quantum corrections. This program has been pursued for maximal supersymmetry, when one can compute loops and higher derivative corrections. But for half maximal supersymmetry, nothing was known. So you have to start somewhere.
Yeah, no, I was just going to the details of the words and what you meant by the word. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Is there any other question? Okay. So before going into the actual computations, let me also give a panorama of the history of these kind of results. In principle, one can use the traditional method, which is you write down the supergravity Lagrangian, you expand in the Kaluza-Klein modes up to quartic interactions, you extract some Feynman rules, and you compute the Witten diagrams, like in ordinary QFT in flat space, and you get the result. But in practice, you encounter problems in this program. First of all, these Lagrangians are not simple at all. So this is the effective type 2B Lagrangian on ADS5 cosinus 5, computed 20 years ago by Arutinov and Frolov. And you can see that these terms are really complicated, so you really don't want to work with a Lagrangian like this. And moreover, Witten diagrams in position space are not that nice at all. This is just a 5^4 interaction, only one term, and each individual diagram can be quite nasty by itself. So the combination of these two aspects makes it essentially impossible to perform explicit computations. But nonetheless, people were able to compute some results, in particular a few for ADS5 cosinus 5 at tree level. Only the four-point function of the stress tensor for ADS7 cosinus 4, still at tree level, and no results at all for ADS4 cosinus 7. So clearly, one needs to change something. And this something is some new tools that it is very useful to introduce, the first of which is Mendelian space. So let me spend a few words on what Mendelian space is. One usually have these four-point correlators in CFT as functions of, well, there is a prefactor dictated by conformal invariance, and then there is a function to be determined, which is a function of two cross ratios U and V. It was found useful to introduce something called the Mendelian transform, which can be thought of as the analog of the Fourier transform for flat space scattering. So one trades the two space-time cross ratios U and V for two Mendelian variables S and T. And we do this integral. You see here it's along an imaginary axis we have U and V, and then we have some gammas, and I will explain the role. And this M is called the Mellin amplitude. And this is the object that I will be focused on. So let me tell you a bit more of what it is. So first of all, these S and T, and we also actually have U here, are where ST and U are constrained by this constraint. They are the analog of the Mandelson variables for flat space scattering. And not only that they satisfy the same constraints, but also in a very precise sense. In particular, if we take large S and T in the Mellin amplitude, what we obtain is a flat space scattering amplitude. So really, these S and T have a very close connection with Mandelson variables. Moreover, as I was telling you, this Mellin transform is performed by integrating in S and T along an imaginary axis. And so we're doing these complex plane integrals so that we can close this contour and sum over the poles that are enclosed in the contour. So poles of the Mellin amplitude and of this prefactor with gamma functions are what really matters. So let me describe the pole structure of the gammas and of M. So first of all, the gammas, they are gamma squared, so they really are double poles, and they are associated to the present to the presence in all holographic CFTs of double trace operators, which are these kind of operators. So two copies of, so you, this is the OPE between two identical operators, O, and double trace operators are those that are quadratic in O, and then we have some derivatives, at least in the free theory. And we can relate these operators to these double poles as follows. If one takes the OPE of a three-level correlator, so when we're, where we have some anomalous dimensions, the expansion of this U to the delta in gamma, so the perturbative expansion of the conformal dimension, gives rise to this anomalous dimension that appears with a logarithm of U in front, just because you're taking the derivative of U to the delta. And if we compare this with some simple stuff that we can have in the complex plane, if we take the residue at a single pole, we only get powers of U, but with no logs. Whereas if we take the residue at the double pole, then we find that there is a log. And so this is teaching us that double poles are related to the existence of long operators, which develop anomalous dimensions. And these long operators are precisely the double trace operators. So this is the poles of the gammas. Let's then look at the poles of M. And in particular, I will be interested with three level. So let me tell you what happens for the two kind of diagrams that we can have at three level for 4 points. The first is contact diagrams that schematically you can imagine being of this form. So derivatives and then phi to the four. These are polynomials in S and T. So they have no poles. And so this means that when we have a contact diagram, this will only give rise to double trace operators in the OP. And moreover, this L, the degree of this polynomial, is exactly one half of the number of derivatives that we have in the interaction, which is also what happens in flat space scattering. So this makes even closer the connection between S and T and Mandelson variables. On the other hand, we can also have exchange diagrams of the type phi to the third. And they have an expression of this kind, which may look a bit nastier than just polynomials. But there is one important thing, which is that they carry some simple poles. And these simple poles are related to the exchange of some single trace operators in the OPE, where the operator that is exchanged corresponds to the case m equals zero in the sum, and then all the terms with the higher values of M are just descendants of the operator that has been exchanged. The residues at this poles are polynomials of degree L, where L is the spin of the exchange operator, and then we have some ambiguities in the definition of cubic terms, which is given by the possibility of adding some contact terms, which is just a field redefinition in our cubic couplings. So this is the structure of Mellin amplitudes, at least at three level, which is the case we're interested in. And so this was the first ingredient that we have to introduce to simplify these computations of holographic correlators. And the second ingredient is that of bootstrap methods. And the philosophy that you can have in mind is that of forgetting about the Lagrangian, essentially. So that long Lagrangian for radius 5 crosses 5, we just don't want to look at it anymore. And what we do instead is we use superconformal invariance, constraints from crossing symmetry, and some consistency conditions to fix the answer. And this, the development and the application of these two methods, Melin space and the bootstrap, led to the full answer, tree level for ADS5 crosses 5. And by full answer, I mean all the K1, K2, K3, K4 for arbitrary Ks correlators. Partial results instead for ADS7 crosses 4 and ADS4 crosses 7. So these two methods that I briefly introduced give you some leverage. You can get more results, but still no organizing principle is apparent. And although you can get the full result for this ADS5 crosses 5 case, for them theory backgrounds, it's really hard to compute these correlators in general. And that's where this new idea arrives and kind of saves the day, which is the idea of the MRV limit, where MRV is for maximally R-symmetry violating. So remember that what we are trying to compute, or what we want to compute, is correlators of these half BS operators, which have K indices in the symmetric traceless representation of SON. And what people commonly do is they contract these indices with some polarization vectors that are null because of the tracelessness condition. And so one ends up with operators that are functions of X, the space-time point, but also of these polarizations T. And when one has a four-point function, one can create cross ratios also with these polarizations T. And these cross ratios I will call sigma and tau. Now let's see in practice what this MRV limit is. So what I'm showing you here is the four-point function of the stress tensor in the 7 crosses 4. And the Melin amplitude that represents this correlator is a function of the Mendelssohn variables SNT, Melin variables SNT, and of these two cross ratios. So this is the full result. As you can see, it looks pretty scary and long. And what happens, which was how this MRV limit was first observed and noticed, is that if you take operators 1 and 3 in the correlator to have the same polarization, which means from the point of view of these cross ratios to take sigma equals to 0 and tau equals to 1, this defines what is called the U-channel MRV limit, and the amplitude becomes very, very much simpler than the general case. And not only it is simpler, so this was introduced by Fernando and Shinan 1 year ago, and not only the amplitude is simpler, but it has some very peculiar features, which are it has no poles in the Melin variable U, and also it has two zeros in U that are factorized. And I will justify these two facts later on. For the moment, just notice that they are there. And they are precisely what allows you to make progress and compute correlators for arbitrary values of the Kaluza-Klein weight. And the name MRV comes from the idea of MHV amplitudes in flat space, where H here is for helicity. H is for helicity. And we can think of gluon scattering in flat space. In that case, by helicity conservation, the amplitude with gluons with all of the same polarization is zero, just by Lorentz invariance, essentially. And same if we have one minus and all plus helicities. This is in four dimensions, of course. But if we take the first result that is non-zero, which is the maximal helicity violating result, so two minus and all the rest is positively polarized, then the result at 10 points is extremely simple, and it is given by this famous Parker-Taylor formula. So the idea is that this MRV limit that I briefly described and that I will describe more in detail later is kind of doing what the MHV limit does for flat space scattering. And let me stress again, this MRV limit allowed to compute all of the four-point functions between all supergravitons in all the maximally supersymmetric theories. So it's really powerful in the sense that we can get an infinite amount of results where with the same method where previously people had to make progress only case by case. Is there any question about this? Okay. So I will proceed with focusing on the case that is of interest for gluon scattering, which is that of holographic theories with half of the maximal supersymmetry. Let's start with a simple example of these kind of theories, and then I will present them more in detail. The example is for n equals 4 super young meals with flavors. The setup is the following. We take nd3 brains in flat space. We know very well that this is dual in the near horizon limit to in the near horizon limit, this gives an ADS5 cross S5 geometry, which is then dual to for n equals 4 super young meals. And what we can do is add to this setup nf d7 brains. And if nf, so the number of d7 brains, is much smaller than n, then we can ignore the back reaction, and the theory, the CFT that we are describing, is still conformal. And so let me show you in space-time how this looks like. We have these D3 brains along the first four directions, and the ADS5 is along the first five, and then the five sphere is the transverse space to that in the 10 dimensions of type 2B. And these D7 brains that I am adding are along all of the ADS5 directions, and also along NS3 contained in the ADS5. And so we can do this. This is still a meaningful geometry, so long as the number of D7 brains is smaller than the number of D3 brains. And it has various effects on the geometry and on the dual field theory. In particular, the first effect is that the D7 brains break one half of the supersymmetries. So the theory that we are describing on the D3 is no longer n equals 4, but rather n equals 2. Moreover, the fact that the D7 are stretched along an S3 inside the S5 break the SO6 isometry of the S5 with the breaking pattern that you can see here. In particular, we are wrapping an S3, so we're preserving the SO4, which is the isometry of the S3, and then we have an S1 with isometry U1 or SO2. And this SO4 is SU2 cross SU2, where the first SU2 is a global symmetry of the CFT, whereas the remaining SU2 cross U1 is their symmetry of this 4D n equals 2 theory. The third effect is that we are adding gluons in our supergravity description, in particular because the D7 brains carry an 8-dimensional super young Mills theory on their world volume, with some gauge group GF, which in this case is just SUNF. And this GF, the gauge group of the super young Mills on the D7, is a flavor group from the point of view of the 4D n equals 2 SCFT. And finally, we can wonder what are the half PPS operators of this 4D n equals 2 theory that lives on the D3 brains. And it turns out that these operators are the KK modes of the D7 gluons on the S3. So these gluons in principle live on ADS5 cross S3, so an 8-dimensional space. But then if we look at the physics from the point of view of the D3 brains, so of this 4D CFT, we have to Kaluza-Klein reduced on the S3, and we get an infinite family of KK modes, which are in the CFT, the half PPS operators. So this is kind of the simplest setup that one can consider for these kind of theories. But there are many families in various dimensions. And in particular, we can distinguish two classes. The first class, which we can describe as brains proper in singularities, is a class of theories in which we completely take into account the back reaction of the brains that we add. And in particular, we have theories in 6, 5, and 4 dimensions. All of them have 8 Poincaré supercharges. And they come from systems where, for instance, here you have M5 and this end of the world M9 brain. Here you have D4 and D8. Here you have D3 and D7 that come from the F theory. So the theories are different, but the common features are that they have half of the maximal supersymmetry. The maximal is 16, so these only have 8 Poincaré supercharges. They all have a singular locus, which is ADS D plus 1 cross S3. So in this case, it's similar to what I described earlier. It will be ADS5 cross S3. Here we have the near horizon D4, so it's ADS5 cross S3. ADS6 cross S3. And here you have ADS7 cross S3. And all of them have kind of the same pattern in the global symmetry group, which is an SU2L global symmetry, and our symmetry factor, and then this GF, which is the gauge group of the gluons on the brains that we're adding, but it is a flavor group from the point of view of the dual CFT. So this is the first class of theories. The other class is that in which we add some flavor brains. So we have to add a small number of them, as I was describing earlier, so that we can ignore the back reaction. And we have two classes here. The first is these n equals four super young meals with flavors, which gives rise to a 4D n equals two theory. Again, we have the seven brains wrapping ADS5 cross S3 and the same kind of structure in the global symmetry group of the CFT. And then we also have 3D n equals six ABJM with flavors that gives rise to a 3D n equals three SCFT. And notice that here we only have six Poincaré supercharges, not eight, but it turns out that the theory can be described exactly with the same kind of techniques. So in general, I would refer to all of these theories as theories with eight, with half maximal supersymmetry, in the sense that the methods apply to all of these in the same way. And in these cases with flavor brains, we have to remember that we can only add a number of flavor brains, which is less than the number of brains that we already had. So less than the number of D3 in this case, and less than the number of M2 in this case. And these two theories, these two classes of theories, also have the same generic features that I highlighted in the previous slide. In addition to the common structure in the symmetry group, across dimensions, we also see, so these theories are in 3, 4, 5, and 6 dimensions, but we also have a pattern in the structure of the half EPS multiplets. And in particular, the super primaries of these half EPS multiplets can be described uniformly in terms of this parameter epsilon, which is the dimension of the CFT minus 2/2. The primary has dimension, the super primary has dimension epsilon times K, where this K is the Kaluza-Klein level. They're all scalars, so spin zero. They have a spin under the SU2R, our symmetry group, which is K/2. We also have an SU2L global symmetry group. And in this case, the spin of the superprimary, which is also that of the full multiplet, is K-2/2. And we also have some flavor symmetry. And all of these operators are adjoint, are in the adjoint representation of the flavor symmetry. In particular, for K=2, these operators, these multiplets are just a conserved current multiplets of the super algebras, where these currents are conserved currents of the flavor group GF. And so since currents are dual to gluons, this will be dual to gluons in ADS with gauge group GF. So precisely the gluons that I was mentioning coming from the D7 brains that we had. Whereas for K > 2, in the supergravity, these operators are dual to the Kaluza-Klein of the modes of the gluons when we compactify on the three sphere that is common to all of the examples. So these operators will now carry more indices than they used to in maximal supersymmetry. In particular, they have an adjoint index, which I'm denoting with I. They have K spinorial indices of SU2R symmetry, which I can contract with K SU2R spinors. And then they also have K-2 spinorial indices of these SU2 left, which I also contract with some spinors. So our operators will have an adjoint index I, they depend on space-time and on two kind of polarizations for SU2R and SU2 left, which you can see here. And what we want to study is four-point functions of these operators.
Sorry, I have a question.
Yeah.
So here somehow you only chose configurations in which the Young-Mills theory lives in the same dimension as the gravity theory. But there are many, I mean, the question is, whatever you're going to do, could you not do it for theories where the D-brain or the Young-Mills theory in the bulk lives in a subspace of your ADS deep, whatever, gravity theory? There are many BPS setups like that.
Yeah, I mean, it would be different, and the same techniques would not apply. The claim is that since we are doing tree level, as I will show you later, we can only focus on interactions between gluons. So I expect the features of the amplitudes I will find to be common to all gluon scattering at three-level in ADS, but yeah. The techniques that I'm going to use only apply to these cases.
Okay, well, we'll see what technique you use, yeah.
And it is what I'm going to show you now, essentially.
I'll wait.
Okay, yeah, this is like the rest of the talk is going to be the technique that I use to compute these results. Yeah, but thanks for the question. So I have these four-point functions of operators in the CFT. For simplicity, let's focus on equal weights. I have a prefactor that is just dictated by kinematics. And then I have a non-trivial function with four indices that are in the adjoint, two space-time cross ratios, and two R-symmetry cross ratios, alpha and beta, made out of the polarizations. It's a bit more nasty, but it's the same thing as a usual bosonic CFT correlator. We have control on the dependence of on alpha and beta, because G must be a polynomial on alpha and beta of degree K and K minus 2 respectively, just because of the number of polarization spinors that I'm contracting with. And moreover, and this will be a crucial ingredient, because of superconformal symmetry, these correlators must satisfy the superconformal word identity that you can see here, where Z and Z bar are related to U and V. So these superconformal word identities relate the dependence on the R symmetry cross ratio alpha to that on the space-time cross ratios Z and Z bar. And now that I've introduced like the background material, let's finally get to the point, which is how we compute these four-point functions between gluons. First of all, a key fact, which is what I was mentioning earlier, I am claiming that what I'm computing is pure gluon scattering, although in a curved background, but without gravity. And this is due to the fact that three-point functions of gluons scale in the CFT with 1 over the current central charge, whereas the interaction between two gluons and one graviton scales with 1 over the stress tensor central charge. And for all the theories that I'm considering, at lowest order in 1 over n, so that's what I mean by I am taking three levels, so the first non-trivial correction, 1 over cj is dominant over 1 over ct, so I can neglect the interaction of gluons with gravity and only focus on pure gluons. So the kind of amplitudes that I will consider have the same structure as those in flat space, where we have four points and three color structures corresponding to the three ST and U channel, where these Fs here are just the structure constants of the gauge group or flavor group that I am considering. So this is the kind of structure of the amplitude. And moreover, we also have an idea of what the ansatz for the amplitude will be, because in flat space, pure Young-Mills theory has a cubic and a quartic vertex that matter for four-point scattering. So here again, if we focus on the S-channel contribution, we will have an ansatz, which is an exchange, just in ADS, not in flat space, plus some contact terms. And this structure is also reflected in the OPE of the dual CFT. If you take the OPE, imagine these two legs here being the two operators in the CFT, and then this leg will be the single trace half EPS operators that we can exchange in the OP. And these are these exchanges. We don't have one, but we have as many as the half EPS operators that can be exchanged. And moreover, the quartic diagram is related to the presence of double trace operators in the OP. So this is very schematic, but let me be more precise. And in particular, this is the kind of ansatz. So here I'm focusing on the S-channel contribution. So this MS that you can see here, proportional to a specific color structure. And MS can be written as a sum over exchanges of half PPS operators. And I'm denoting the exchange of the full half PPS multiplet, not just the superprimary, by this SP. And this comes together with some OPE coefficients that are essentially the three-point functions between the external operators and the exchange ones, and also some SU2L polynomials that depend on beta, but this is just kinematics. So it has to be here, but there is full control on this. The crucial part will be computing this SP. And then in addition to the part with the exchanges, we also have the possibility of having contact diagrams. And we have we fix the amplitude in two steps. The first step will be that of fixing the individual exchanges of half PPS multiplets using the MRV limit. And then the second step is once we have fixed what this SP is, we have a full-fledged ansatz for MS and so for the full amplitude. And then we apply the superconformal worded entities to the ansatz and fix all of the OP coefficients that I stress here are not known in these SCFTs or were not known in the SCFTs. So let me first focus on the first step, which is that of fixing this exchange of the half PPS multiplet. For simplicity, let me focus on the case of 4DN equals 2 just to show you something, which is a table from this very famous paper with where super multiplets are classified. And in green, I have highlighted the representations that are compatible, that can be exchanged in the correlator and are compatible with the symmetries. You see, it's only a subset of all the operators in the multiplet, but still, it is not just a superprimary. More in general, in every dimension that we are interested in, again, we can write things uniformly in the dimension using this epsilon, which is d minus 2 over 2. And the operators that can be exchanged from these supermultiplets are the superprimary, which is scalar, and here you have its quantum numbers, a spin 1 field, which is the gluon of the multiplet, or the current from the point of view of the CFT, and then the bottom component, which is another scalar. So we have these three operators that you can exchange. And then when you make an ansatz for the exchange of the supermultiplet, which I was calling SP, this must include three pieces, 1, 2, and 3, each corresponding to one of the three representations that can be exchanged. These Ys in the ansatz that depend on alpha are Jacobi polynomials of SU2. So they are just a trivial dependence that we have full control on this R symmetry cross ratio alpha. So we know all of these Ys explicitly. The Ms instead depend on two parameters, delta and L, which are the dimension and the spin of the exchanged operator. You see this as dimension epsilon P and spin zero. It is the superprimary. Then you have the first descendant and the second descendant. Again, we know all of these explicitly. So what we miss here is the knowledge of these two coefficients, which are just real numbers that I'm calling lambdas. And the non-trivial question to ask that people weren't able to answer until not so long ago is how to fix these coefficients. And the idea is that to use the MRV limit, which for the case of 8 supercharges corresponds to taking V1 equals 2V3. So essentially we are aligning the polarizations of operators 1 and 3, which sets alpha to 0. And my claim that I will soon justify is that two things happen in this configuration. The first is that the Mellin amplitude has no poles in the Mellin variable U. And moreover, the amplitude also has a single zero located at U equals to epsilon k. And my claim is that this holds for all individual exchanges. So we can apply these two constraints when alpha is zero to all of the to the ansatz for the super multiplet exchange. So I write this structure where I know everything except for the lambdas. I set alpha to zero. I require a single zero at U equals two epsilon k. And what I obtain is that this fixes the lambdas completely. So that now I have the explicit form of the super multiplet exchange. And that's not the end of the story, because you may have objected that there is an ambiguity in the definition of exchange Mellin amplitudes related to the possibility of adding contact terms. But once you fix these lambdas, and you also must have a zero in U, a single zero in U, you have the poles in S, and you have that the residues are degree one in U, which is all you can have if you're exchanging a spin one operator. So the structure of spin one exchanges, even in flat space, is that the residues at the poles have to be degree one, but this is completely fixed. And these SPs, you can see, are well behaved when we take the U-channel Reggie limit, which is defined by taking S and T to infinity. Because we have this U here, which remains fixed in this limit, the behavior is like 1 over S. So the prescription to use for these exchange Mellin amplitudes is that of using the so-called Polyakov Reggie blocks, which have this improved behavior. So really both the Ys and the Ms are fixed. There is no ambiguity related to contact terms. So I claim that this fixes the exchanges completely, but let's see why we have this single zero, which was crucial, and why we have no poles in U. The statement that we have no poles in U is actually a bit simpler to visualize. The reason is that when we set V1 equals to V3, then we are aligning polarizations and we are selecting only one representation in the tensor product of SU2 representations of operators 1 and 3. And this is the representation with spin K1 plus K3 over 2. But in ADS-CFT, we have that extremal three-point functions of half BPS operators are all vanishing. And so in particular, this operator is not exchanged in the OP between K1 and K3. And since the exchange of short operators is related to single poles, then we cannot have poles in U when we take V1 equals to V3. So this is the statement about the poles. Another way to see that is that all of the R-symmetry polynomials, so the Y of alpha that I was showing earlier, in the U channel are proportional to some power of alpha. So very simply, when you take alpha to zero, they vanish and there is no room for U channel exchanges in this limit. We also have the statement that the amplitude must have a single zero at U equals 2 epsilon K. And this is related to the decoupling of some long operators. In particular, consider KKKK for simplicity. And we know that in large N theories, all long operators are double trace. And the ones with the lowest twist are those made of operator, some derivatives, which give spin, but no boxes. And so their twist, which is dimension minus spin, is 2 epsilon K, so 2 times the dimension of the external operator. And for a long supermultiplet to be exchanged in the U channel and to be visible in the MRV limit, the superprimary, not all of the operators, but the superprimary must have this spin. However, then all of the operators in the supermultiplet with exactly this twist decouple in the MRV limit, so they cannot develop anomalous dimensions. So the claim is when we take alpha to zero, there are no long operators in the theory with this twist, 2 epsilon k. But since the gamma functions in the prefactor of the Mellin amplitudes have double poles at that value of the twist, then we must cancel the double pole with a zero in such a way that there are no anomalous dimensions in the limit alpha equals zero. And therefore, there must be this simple zero, the single zero at U equals 2 epsilon k. To see this even more explicitly, again, let's look at a table. I select for 4DN equals 2, for instance, the representations I'm interested in for the exchange of a long multiplet. I put them in a smaller table for simplicity. And you can see that the only allowed value for the spin of the superprimary is this k minus 2. But then if you look at all the values of the spin of the superdescendants, there is only one operator which has spin k, which is the choice of plus here. And this is the only operator that survives when I take the MRV limit. So in general, all of these are exchanged, but in the MRV limit, only this operator. And notice that this has twist equals to the twist of the primary plus 2. And in particular, if you look at the only operators with the same twist as the primary, which are these two, they have a spin that is different from K, so they vanish. Their contribution vanishes in the MRV limit, so they decouple. And this is why if we take the twists to be the minimum one, then in the MRV limit, all of the operators with this twist decouple, and then we must have this single zero. Sorry, this was a bit technical, but let's go back to the actual story. So I wanted to justify this crucial step of taking the MRV limit.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
Since you said it's a bit technical, what's the physics of this MRV limit?
So it is essentially When you take the OPE of operators with some R symmetry representation, then the operators that can be exchanged are have all the linking labels of their symmetry group that are compatible with that tensor product. And when you take the MRV limit, you're essentially selecting only one of those representations, so all the others decouple. So this allows you to simplify essentially the structure of the correlator. And since you have superconformal symmetry, then the space-time and their symmetry dependence are tied together. And so you're able to actually completely fix these dynamics of the exchange just by looking at the kinematics of the tensor product of SU2 representations. I don't know if the answer was clear enough.
Yeah, mathematically I understand, but physically you are at some point making an analogy with this MHV limit that we are used to, right? That
Yeah, it's very much an analogy at this point in that in the MHV limit, you really have, well, in a sense, it's the same in that you look at the limit in which you are you're going to an extremum of the allowed range of possible values in this tensor product. So in the MHV limit, you can only have two polarizations of one kind of and all the rest of another kind. It's the first that is non-trivial, or it is the most trivial one. And similarly, in the MRV limit, in general, you have a complicated dependence. When you take alpha to zero, you really have the simplest one. And moreover, the expectation that is subject of some work in progress is that this kind of structure in the MRV limit will actually carry on for higher point functions. And so kind of the dream of this approach is that of having the analog of the Parker-Taylor formula for ADS-CFT correlators. So MRV limit for any number of points. Okay. I don't know if it's more satisfying.
Yeah, I don't see the analogy with MHV, but it might be my fault. The way I understood it, but tell me if it's wrong, but it's still, I would still call it a technical explanation, is that there is this limit where you make contact with this BPS sector, this twisted holography, that when you tune the cross ratio and the R charge, right? But here, instead, you fix first the R charge to a trivial value, and then you do the OP expansion. But when you do the OP expansion, effectively, the space-time is now being expanded around the same point as the space-time and the R charge are expanded around the same point because you took the R charge to be trivial. So the OP is also the limit where things trivialize supersymmetrically, right? And that's why you gain a new control.
There is a new closer connection. Yeah, sorry, you were saying something?
So it's a more supersymmetric point than... you make the OPE a supersymmetric point as well because you tune the R charge to also to be the leading term in the OPE, right?
Yes. In fact, so there are two comments that related to this twisted holography that you were mentioning. So when you have a chiral algebra, which is not the case for all the theories that I consider, only for a subsector, but when you have a chiral algebra, you can actually reproduce the four-point functions of that chiral algebra only looking at the MRV limit. So if you're interested in reproducing those correlators, all you need to do is look at the Mellin amplitude in the MRV limit. You don't need the full amplitude.
Makes sense.
And yes, and the other comment is that, however, you don't always have the chiral algebra, but this approach also works for theories without the chiral algebra. For instance, for 5D or 6D n equals 1, you don't have a chiral algebra, but still this MRV limit makes sense. So it's kind of intermediate, I would say. It doesn't trivialize completely. But yeah, thanks for the comment. It's very much related to that. So I still have 5 minutes, so I'll try and conclude. So by taking this MRV limit, we were able to fix this super exchange of a gluon supermultiplet that I'm writing here in a compact form where these R's are some residues that we fixed with MRV limit. So these are relatively complicated functions, actually just polynomials in TNU, but with some gammas of I, P, and M, but we know everything of this. So what we do then is we put everything together in an S-channel contribution where we have all of the possible exchanges, and this is fully known except for the OP coefficients. And then we also allow for the possibility of some contact terms, which are these, we allow only for degree zero contact terms in STNU, because we know that we must match gluon scattering in flat space, and the contact term of Young-Mills theory have no derivatives, so degree zero. And so just by using Bose symmetry, we have also an answer for MT and MU, the TNU channels. And what we do is we apply the superconformal worded entities to these ansatz. And this is enough to fix completely all of the OP coefficients between the half BPS operators in terms of that between three currents. And let me stress that these are completely new. So we didn't know these OP coefficients before, but the MRV limit plus the worded entities are enough to fix them all. And moreover, this also fixes the contact terms to zero. So in my ansatz, I allow for the presence of some contact terms, but it turns out that these Polyakov Regi blocks that I used for the Malini exchanges are precisely what I needed to make it completely obvious that only three-point couplings matter, which is a lesson that people learned many years ago in flat space QFT. And the result is that everything is in terms of this three-point function of the current, which can we can express in terms of the current central charge. And in all the theories that we consider, it is true that the central charge of the current is subleading with respect to that of the graviton. So we can really neglect the contribution of the gravitons. And using the explicit values of CJ that were computed for most of the theories that I listed earlier, our results are all of the four-point functions between all of the super gluons of arbitrary weights in this series for in dimensions 3, 4, 5, and 6. And just to show you briefly how the results look like. So first of all, let me stress, sorry, that only the four-point function of the stress tensor was known and only in dimension 5 and 6 previously from this paper by Shinan. So this is really, really new, even if it's just three-level. And this is how the results look like. This is the simplest case. For dn equals 2 and to 2kk, you see that we have this simple pulse in STNU related to the exchanges in the three channels. 1 over CJ is 1 over n, where n is the number of the three brains, and it's dominant on CT, which is 1 over n squared. And when we take the MRV limit, which is setting alpha to 0, you see exactly the features that I highlighted before. So this single 0 in U, and no poles in the U channel. And then I will have something more to say about hidden structures in these results, but I think the time is over, so I will just flash through it very quickly. One important aspect is-
You started 1 minute late and there were a few questions, so take 2 minutes.
Okay. Yeah, okay, thanks. Something that I really want to stress is what the flat space limit of these results looks like. Let me remind you that the flat space limit for Malini amplitudes corresponds to taking S and T to infinity. We have some structure with some normalizations, some polynomials in alpha and beta that are relatively trivial. And then we have some A of ST and alpha. And this A has this form. It has simple poles at ST and U equals to 0 with numerators that satisfy the famous color kinematics duality in flat space. And moreover, these A's, these amplitudes, are really describing the scattering of gluons in a space-time, which is like this. So here, the blue space represents the boundary of ADSD plus one. And our gluons have momenta along this, this boundary. And moreover, they are polarized in NR4, which is like the decompactification of the S3. And the gluons have polarizations that are along this R4. And the Malin variables S and T and U become exactly the Mandelson variables made out of this momenta. And the SU2 cross ratio alpha is the cross ratio made with these polarization vectors. So this is a very important point that really makes it up. And this A is exactly matches the flat space amplitude of gluons. And this makes it really apparent and concrete that we're studying the scattering of gluons. And also the kind of geometry where these gluons live in. Moreover, not only we have color kinematics duality in the flat space limit, But also, if we consider the four-point function of the stress tensor in all dimensions, we can write it in this form, where here I have a leading pole, and then all of these poles are other poles that come from the descendants. I have some kinematic numerators that come from the full ADS amplitude, and not only the algebraic Jacobi identity holds, but also the kinematic analog of the Jacobi identity is true in the full ADS bulk. And so what we have is color kinematics duality in ADS, which is really apparent in our results. And it is even more so in this subsequent paper by Shinan, where double copy in ADS was also observed. And we also have this, I'll be very brief because it's very late. We have a dimensional reduction structure reminiscent of what is known as Parisi-Sourla supersymmetry, which relates a superconformal field theory in D dimensions to a CFT in D minus two. And what we see in our results is that we can write the exchanges of the supermultiplets as some differential operator acting on a purely bosonic exchange of scalars in D minus one dimensions rather than D plus one. So secretly, our superconformal field theories come from bosonic CFTs in two dimensions less. And moreover, something that is known to work for ADS5 crosses 5 and ADS3 crosses 3 is hidden conformal symmetry. So those correlators enjoy a hidden conformal symmetry in higher dimensions. And the same holds for our gluon results in four dimensions. So four-point functions of these FPPS operators in ADS5 crosses 5 actually have a 10-dimensional conformal symmetry. In ADS3 crosses 3, they have a six-dimensional one. And for our ADS5 crosses 3, we have an eight-dimensional one where this eight is exactly the dimension of the world volume of the D7 brains, which is where the gluons live. And I think with this, I can really conclude, just give some outlook, stuff that we would like to do in the future. Core kinematics duality and double copy are something that people doing amplitudes really like, and there's a lot of work on those. They're not really explored in ADS. And so it is very interesting to look at these in ADS, and our results allow to study these. And we want to go to, for instance, compare with gravity, but also go to higher point functions, because core kinematics duality and double copy are present for any number of points. So study these properties of the amplitudes. And from the point of view of instead looking at quantum gravity, so to justify my initial claims, now we have the tree level, which should be the basis for systematic explorations of results at loops, higher derivative corrections. And also, since now we have gluons, we can make gluons and gravitons interact. And so we can exchange gravitons between gluons or have external mixtures of gluons and gravitons. So entirely new classes of observables from the point of view of this story of holographic correlators. And instead, from the point of view of the CFTs, we have computed new CFT data, both protected ones, the OP coefficients between the half PPS operators that, as I stressed, were not known, but also by doing the OPEs of our results, one can obtain an infinite amount of unprotected CFT data. And again, if you do higher point functions or study subleading corrections, you can explore these strongly coupled CFTs, which I think is very fascinating. And that's it. Thank you very much for bearing with me, and sorry for being a bit late.
Perfect. Thank you. Questions? Maybe I have a general question while people think. So what is your general, what is the big picture goal of studying gluons? Of course, as you said, you can generalize and put gluons and gravitons, study a few corrections, but what's the big picture? What do you really expect to learn? So are gluons simpler than gravitons? Do you think?
Exactly. I think this is the main point. So in a sense, we already know this from basic QFT. Gluons have one index, gravitons have two. And people have, this is naive, but people have used it explicitly. For instance, the double copy has been used to study the UV behavior of graviton amplitudes for D n equals 8 supergravity, where it's unclear where the UV divergences appear. So one can really study quantum gravity, theories of quantum gravity, but instead of computing results with gravitons, one compute gluons, which are simpler, and then by the double copy, we can learn about gravitons. So I think this is one fascinating aspect of the story. The other one is that we know a lot of features of the amplitudes of gluons in flat space, and we would really like to understand whether these, so some of them are proved, so we just expect them to be there, some of them are not. And so we would like to see whether they are an accident of flat space or really a feature of these gate theories that is not manifest in the Lagrangian. And I think going to curve space is a first step to check how non-trivial these features are and if they are actually there in all cases.
Okay, I have another question, but I'll let Davide first.
In which of your examples do you expect to be able to go at order one over n, or one over n squared, and so on? Because I mean, when you have these seven brains, you lose conformal symmetry, right? At order one over n, or one over n squared, sure. So that presumably
stops things. No, in the F theory example, so I have two for these setups. One is that in which you add probe brains and you neglect the back reaction. So there you have to be careful with how many of those you're adding. But the other setup was a full-fledged F-theory background where you're including the back reaction of the D7 brains and the theory is conformal. So that is an actual CFT. And in that case, actually, there was a recent paper by Fernando Shinan and Agnese for sure. Sorry, I hope I'm not missing anyone. Anyway, there was a recent follow-up in which they were doing one loop of gluons. And that is actually, I think, the only setup in which it is, of course, non-trivial, but it is the simplest case. For the other dimensions, it's going to be harder for technical reasons.
But the theories are conformal beyond.
It is a conformal theory, I think.
Can you tell me, maybe along those lines, then, can you tell me a little bit about the gauge theory definition of this four-point function? I don't know much about this D-brain, coupling this D-brain to n equals 4. So what am I computing in the gauge theory in n equals 4, for example?
It is not really, I don't think it is n equals 4.
Yeah, I agree. But in the case that you start with n equals 4 and then you deform.
Okay. Yeah, in a sense,
what am I computing there?
Yeah, from a superalgebra perspective, if you wish, what you do is you take the, for the n equals 4, stress tensor multiplet or the half BCS multiplet of n equals 4, you decompose in for the n equals 2 multiplets, and you only take the half BPS part. So in a sense, you look at the gluons that are inside the graviton multiplets. So the for the n equals 4 multiplet contains both a current and a stress tensor. But from the for the n equals 2 perspective, the stress tensor is 1/4 BPS. So you're only focusing on the gluonic or current part that is in the full stress tensor multiplet.
Yeah, sorry for my very naive question, but in n equals 4, I can consider these 4-point functions of gravitons and then study them at weak coupling in the gauge theory, at strong coupling, mm-hmm. and I could in principle put it in a computer and so on. What is the definition, similar definition of this K1, K2, K3, K4 for the gluons? Could I also study it at the analog of weak coupling if I wanted to put
I didn't get the question earlier. I don't think there is an analog of weak coupling. I think all of these theories are inherently strongly coupled. Or maybe for the 4D case, you can go to weak coupling regime, but the true answer is I'm not familiar with what the description is in that case. I think for the 3, 5, and 6D cases, you have strong coupling essentially. But yeah, I'm not familiar with the Lagrangian description of these theories. That is the honest answer.
But yeah, aren't these correlators of mesons?
Sorry, can you say that again?
I think Pedro is looking like it's correlation functions of mesonic operators of the boundary gauge. Uh-huh. No, you have new fields in the fundamental. You can create new gauge variants.
Yeah, that's true. Yes.
So it's exactly the same. It's usually this.
Yeah, because, Yeah, you're breaking n equals 4 to n equals 2, so you can add new terms, and yes, it must be that.
So it's some four-point function of some quark, and then a bunch of scalars, and then some q-bar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so one could study those at weak coupling as well, and have spin chains and open spin chains and stuff like this.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I don't remember that this seven brain was an integrable boundary condition.
Was this what Leonardo was studying? No,
that was
but a different one.
Yeah, and there was no dual, I think.
But if you're allowed to break rotational symmetry, there are certainly integrable boundary conditions. And this goes back to what I asked before. I mean, I didn't follow all the details, but it sounds like whatever you've done could be extended to the cases where the deeper end is not fully wrapping into ADS in the bulk. And you didn't care at all about the bulk graviton. So how could you care about whether the deeper end wraps the whole ADS or not? It's an exercise in superconformal representation theory.
So you're not wrapping the full ADS, that's what you're saying.
If I'm brain wrapping ADS four times
S2. Yeah,
you're like looking at the subsector of the theory.
No, it's a theory that has only three-dimensional Poincaré invariants, not four-dimensional Poincaré invariants.
The main wall,
yeah.
Okay, yes.
Or other codimensions. I mean, you can do it for many codimensions.
But what does this do? Can you preserve all of the supersymmetry?
No, half. We can preserve at most half, of course.
Okay, but then you're breaking n equals 2 to n equals 1.
No, half for the n equals 4. So you get n equals 4 inside for the n equals 4.
Yeah.
Or you get things like that.
Aha, okay.
You get a different supergroup. So, it's a half EPS supergroup.
The crucial thing for all of this really was having at least 8 supercharges, so or having enough supercharges to have superconformal worded entities.
Well, you cannot make
progress. But if you have at least SU2R symmetry, then I suppose that very similar techniques would apply.
That's what I would think, yeah.
Why do you need to have an S3? I mean, to have SU2R symmetry, you need an S2, right?
Yes, you're right. We also have in all of these theories an SU2 global symmetry that was actually important. So if you look at the structure of the worded entities, which I hope to be able to show you here. Okay, so here you have alpha, beta, z, and z bar, and you have the word entity setting alpha equals 1 over z or 1 over z bar. In the maximally superconformal case, you also have an alpha bar, and so you really have 4 combinations. Here you're reducing the number of combinations that you have, so the word entities are less powerful, but they must hold for any value of this beta, which is this SU2 global symmetry cross ratio. And this is what makes them powerful enough to fix the result. So one aspect is you want the SU2R symmetry to have the word entities in the first place. And once you have them, for them to be powerful enough to fix the result, you also want this SU2L global symmetry. And that is what allows you to make progress and fix everything. So that's why I think the S3 is important.
But why would that global symmetry have to act on space-time precise as rotations of an S3? In this example, with the five brains we were mentioning, it has an ADS 4 times S2. Their symmetry relates to S2.
You're right. It doesn't need to come from a space-time.
But there is another S2 that rotates the directions in S5 perpendicular to S2.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give an example.
Yeah. Sorry, I wasn't familiar with that. I didn't think about it. But I think the crucial ingredient is SU2R symmetry and another SU2 symmetry. I don't think this necessarily has to come from the S3, but in all the cases that we looked at, this was the case. So there is this family which shares all of these features, but it might be the case that it's enough for this SU2 to come from some other geometric realization in supergravity.
Sorry, let me again be a little bit provocative. You could say that all this double copy is a technical tool for integrants that anyway, I mean, eventually you lose energy, you stop at four loops or three loops, perhaps you can write a few integrants, but who cares? What exactly could be the physics that we could learn by studying gluons in ADS? Is it about learning about infrared divergences? I mean, why would I care? Scattering gravitons, I understand. We know nothing about scattering gravitons, but why would I care about scattering gravitons in ADS?
Well, in a sense, I think you should care for the same reasons why you care about scattering gravitons, because as I said, you can recover these gravitons from this. More in general, you can learn about QFTs in curved space. And like, I think the first studies of gauge theories in ADS were precisely, as you mentioned, to regulate these IR divergences that you have in gauge theories. So that's another point. If you want results for gauge theories in ADS, this is like an efficient way to obtain them. And as I said, I really think there is studying gauge theories is not worse than studying, it's not less interesting than studying gravity, because you can also have, you have more, since you have less supersymmetry, you have different kinds of observables. You can have, these gluons come from the D7 brain, say, but we only look at them propagating on the D3, so in a subspace, but then you also have gravitons going around in the full space. So you can study more complicated ADS-CFT setups. And so for instance, you have more non-trivial quantities that you can compute and perform these matches from gravity and gauge theory in ADS-CFT.
No, I agree, of course. You can generalize and you only have a rich story. But I wondered if you had a physical question that you would like to understand. Something that you don't know in physics and that you think, okay, maybe in 3 years, by studying all these gluons in ADS, I will know the answer to this. What would be a question that we don't know that we will learn in 3 or 4 years by studying gluons in ADS?
So I think there are some, they're not necessarily related to the fact that these are gauge theories, but to the fact that we have more holographic correlators that we have control on. For instance, one aspect of going towards quantum gravity, one aspect of the story that I like is how when you go to loops, then you want to kind of square the three-level anomalous dimensions, and you have some mixing problem, and how the square of the average and the average of the square of these anomalous dimensions behave gives you an idea of how many internal directions you have in your space-time. So you can address questions like scale separation in ADS-CFT, whether the internal manifold must be the same as the radius of ADS. And you could only, before this, you could only do that essentially for three cases, the three maximally supersymmetric ones. Whereas here we have more observables. So we have a variety of cases where we can also tune parameters. Because it's less rigid, I think it gives you access to a larger family of observables. And ultimately, this will be actually a study of gravity, not of gauge theory. Because as soon as you move from this three level, you are forced to introduce gravity. It's not an option. And then you also see how gravity interacts with the gauge theories. And also at some point—
Why is it you need to introduce gravity?
Sorry?
Why is it you need to introduce gravity? What prevents you from studying gauge theory in rigid ADS?
Because in this ADS-CFT setup?
Oh, I know that, but you don't know what, you know, you're just bootstrapping things, right? So you're doing the most general possible thing. Why do you need to add gravity?
Yeah, but we are looking at specific theories. And in those theories, for instance, if you take 4D, this is a specific CFT that comes from these F-theory singularities. And 1 over Cj is 1 over n, 1 over Ct is 1 over n squared. So as soon as you do loops of gluons, you want to do loops. So the perturbative order would be 1 over n squared, which is the same as the interaction with gravity. So self-consistency of this theory is telling you that you also have gravity.
But how did this theory know that it was that theory?
Sorry?
How does this theory? So you're saying that the moment you have not just the gluons, but you have these extra causal Klein powers, you need to have gravity? Is that the message?
Yes, because of the dual holographic description.
No, but suppose I did not know the holographic dual. It's just saying you're doing a very general story, right? That applies to all of these examples. The only thing that you change is CJ, correct?
Okay, so if you wish, from the purely bootstrap point of view, so you don't know what you're doing, you just use self-consistency and crossing symmetry. Then a strong self-consistency check is whether you're capable of satisfying the word identities. And I am pretty sure that you would not be able to do it if you do not include the exchanges of gravitons. So you make an ansatz, you impose Bose symmetry, but then you also want the word entities to hold. And they can only hold if you include everything that you need to include in your ansatz. And if you don't include the exchange of gravitons, it's impossible to satisfy the word entities.
But until you get to one loop, you don't see this.
I think yes. Yes, you do see this.
You see it at three level, maybe?
At three level, you don't.
Okay.
At three level, we were able to satisfy the word entities without including gravitons. And the reason is this. But as soon as you go to one loop, you have the expectations that you may have if you wish to include gravitons. So you can imagine an ansatz being alpha times gluon loop plus beta times graviton exchange. And you can wonder whether it's consistent to set beta to zero. And what the word entities tell you is that it's non-consistent. You will have beta being some function of alpha. So they must live together.
So that would be an interesting statement, right? That somehow you cannot have this theory, this gauge theory in ADS4, in ADS, I don't know, 5 times S3, as a gauge theory in rigid. Which I mean, it's not unreasonable because it's a eight-dimensional gauge theory. But it'd be a nice example where you can see that you need to throw in a graviton to make sense of gauge theory in eight dimension. That would be.
It's one. It's
a gauge theory.
Maybe an equivalent.
So I have to go and pick up my daughter, but thank you for the talk.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So you're compactifying. So you're not just looking at the gauge theory. You're looking at a Kaluza-Klein compactification theory. So maybe that plays a role in that.
But still, it does, you know, in eight dimensions, there were only gluons, right? And then you got this Kaluza-Klein tau you're studying comes from gluons in eight dimensions.
Yes.
So it would be interesting to see a situation where you discover that this eight-dimensional gauge theory is not consistent unless you throw in gravitons.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. I'm trying to see if it's somehow trivial instead, but I think it's a very interesting comment. I don't have much to add to that.
It's a statement about the globals of this gauge theory, right? You could say that these globals are massless.
Sorry, which one is the statement about the gauge theory?
These eight-dimensional theories of gluons,
mm-hmm.
somehow, if I understand correctly, our statement contains, as if you do a careful analysis of the states flowing, it is capable of producing these gravitons, right?
Right, in 10 dimensions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's like saying this theory produces glue balls in some higher dimensions, and these glue balls are effectively massless in higher dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny. Okay, now that is cool. Thanks very much, Pietro.
Yeah, thank you very much for your attention. And thanks for inviting me, especially.